Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome to a special series on the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. I'm Laurel Donnellan here with my dear friend and co-host, Daryl Brown. Join us as we dive deep into our personal journeys, sharing stories from different stages of our lives. In each episode, we'll interview one another about a chapter, starting with how we grew up and ending with where we are now. We will be discussing our history and the lessons that shaped our lives and approach to leadership. Daryl, it's great to see you again.
Good to see you.
How are you today?
Doing pretty well. Summer's shooting by and, you know, it's warm here in Dallas. Just got back from New York. Saw some old friends of mine. Played a little golf. So I'm in a good place.
Good. So the last time we got together, you told us about Fordham and your basketball career there and your academic career, and then a little bit about what happened after college. Why don't you tell us anything that we might have missed, you might have thought about since then related to that part of your life?
Well, I guess where I left off, you know, I think I talked about how much fun I had in college. But I really want to, it always astounds me that I never really, as far as basketball's concerned, my goal was never to be a basketball player. It just never was. I always thought, I mean, I was good, but I never thought that I'd be NBA good. The NBA was never a thought in my mind. So by the time when I was a senior in college and I was, you know, I was averaging 27 points and 14 rebounds a game at one point, which was pretty good nationally ranked. You know, I started getting a lot of notice, so that, you know, when the draft came after my senior year and the Boston Celtics took me, I was so proud to be a Boston Celtic that they cared enough and thought that I could play for them, because the history of the Celtics is just, it's fabled. And of course, my favorite player of all time is Bill Russell. Because he wasn't flashy, he did all the, you know, he rebounded, he blocked shots. He was the ultimate team player. And that was always the type of player I wanted to be. And when I say team player, Bill Russell, if you look at his history, Bill Russell was on the forefront of the civil rights movement. And I'll never forget, you know, stories about him being in Boston, which was famous for its discriminatory practices. You know, it was a blue collar Irish town, and, you know, blacks lived out there someplace. And anyway, now here they have this guy, Bill Russell, who was a fabulous, fabulous basketball player. But even he wasn't really accepted as one of their own. Yet he persevered, and he won, like, I don't know, 10 championships, eight or 10 championships, eventually became a player coach of the Celtics. You know, what a career he had, and what a giant of a man he was. So he was always one of my favorite guys. So to be drafted by them was like unbelievable to me. And I went up there. So here I am wearing green and white, something I never thought I'd even be. And it was hard. It was hard because I was a really, really good college player. But when it came to the NBA, it was a completely different level. And I was not NBA good. I would have been a marginal player. So I got released early my first year that I was trying out for them. I went through the process. I made it to training camp. I played in the exhibition season. And, the bottom line is they were better players. And I wasn't quite ready to play in the NBA then. I had to go, they suggested I go over to Europe, work on my outside game, facing the basket. I did a lot of inside. I played a lot closer to the hoop in college. But at 6'7", 215 pounds, I was not playing close to the hoop in the NBA with guys who were 7 foot, 270 pounds. So, but I went over to Europe and I worked on my game and I played in Milan, I played in Sweden, mostly. And I got better. I got a lot better and went back to the Celtic camp and went through the whole process of trying out again and going through training camp. And I know I was written up in the papers, the difference in my play was very noticeable. And anyway, and I still got released 2 days before the season started. And I knew then that was the first time that I really wanted something. I really wanted to make that team. And it was devastating for me. I first of all, I was playing well enough that I should have made it. They made a trade at the last moment for an all-star, and they had to release somebody, and that somebody was me. I went back to Sweden, and I think there was a little bit of depression that came over me. I didn't feel like I needed to be there. I knew I needed to be in the NBA, and I didn't make it. And so I had a good season over there, and I came back, but I learned something about myself. I learned that I learned that I had hit my level. I had worked so hard that I didn't know how else to get better. And when I went back that year, there was something in me that just wasn't I didn't want to be there. And I think I failed my physical that last year. And well, let me skip back. That winter I was home. I came home for Christmas, and I met the Fordham coach said, if you want to come back to coach here, you can go, we'll pay for any graduate school that you want to go to. And right then I decided that was my major pivot, that I would go back to grad school, get a for communications management. And I did. And it was the best decision I ever made. Really, it was the absolute best. And Fordham University was the place that allowed me to do that. Laurel, you talked about it, the Jesuit education and what that does for character, what it does for how you communicate with others, how you care for others. It changed me in ways that I really enjoyed.
I have two questions about this chapter. I think I've always wanted to ask you this, and I'm not sure I ever have. First one is, what did living in Europe do for you at such a young age, as far as your view of the world?
Interesting. I was 22, 23, and I probably didn't spend enough time in some of the countries I played in to really get a feel for what it was like. Yeah, I played in, I actually played in two different cities in Italy, and I also played in Belgium. But I wasn't there long enough to really get a feel for the people or the culture, you know. And when you're playing basketball overseas, they really, they're slave masters over there. They don't want you to do anything but produce for their team. Right. And that's the only reason why you're there, for that reason and that reason only. And what you do on your free time, which isn't much, you can cram some stuff in, but not really. You didn't really want to go to museums and sit with people you didn't know. Okay. But when I went to Sweden, I did get to know a lot of folks in Denmark, in Copenhagen. I spent a lot of time over there. And I played in Malmo, which is in the south of Sweden. So Malmo and Copenhagen share a lot, and I enjoyed myself there. I took Swedish classes. I think I had a favorite restaurant. They knew me there. I taught in the school system. I think the kids liked me there. I enjoyed working with them. And I got to see a different side of me, right, through them. I think that, you know, an older woman was teaching me Swedish, and she was surprised that I wanted to take the time to do that, because where else in the world do you speak Swedish but in Sweden? It's not like it's an international language. But yeah, I learned a lot about myself, more about myself there than I did about the countries I was
Yeah.
in.
I had a mentor once who said, "Sometimes you need to leave your country to learn about yourself."
Yeah, well, I certainly did. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
good. That's a good question.
Yeah. And before you pivot into your next career and your graduate degree, what did you bring from team sports into your business life?
Well, I think the first thing is perseverance. You know, perseverance and team building was huge. I loved, I captained all of the teams that I was on. And I believe I told you about Bill Russell for a reason, because I was never a selfish player. I always wanted to, you know, being a unit made a big difference for me. It made a lot of sense. You know, always bigger. You know, an individual is can't get it done all by himself or herself. You need a strong team behind you. And there were so many things on the court that I couldn't do that I needed other people to do. Right. So they had to feel confident in doing what they do. And the only way they can feel confident is if you allow them to do it and encourage them to hone their skills in whatever that position called for. So I loved hoops. I loved hoops. And I especially loved defense, because you know, that's where you nobody really wants to play defense, because there's no glamour in it. But when you play outstanding defense, it is the ultimate in team, because you're covering not just your guy, but you're covering maybe a mistake that somebody else makes, right? And you're sometimes covering two men. So yeah, team building was one of the biggest ones. Leadership in terms of you know, captaining, you know, being the captain of teams. And you know, in college, my senior year, my junior year, we did not win a lot, but we played hard. You know, we played really hard, and we played against some, you know, we were a mid-level college, but we played major college teams. You know, we would play Maryland and Notre Dame and USC and you know, all these huge schools, Michigan, and you know, we were a little Fordham, but we would invite them to Madison Square Garden, which I always wanted to do, and we'd play there. And or we go to their place. And so anyway, getting over the mountain, always pushing the
I mean, I think
uphill.
in
That's great.
business, you always have downturns and you have to play hard during the downturns, right? And I love the, you know, I think the we have to share the ball with our team, you know, whatever we're creating in business. So, okay, so let's move on to your graduate degree and what you did after school, after
Sure.
the second stint.
So I went back to grad school, and I had a great 2 years in grad school. I got my degree in a couple of years, and it was 1977 through 1980. And I love, Laurel, your story. You talked about Saturday Night Fever, because the Bee Gees were the first. The Bee Gees gave me my break. So an interview with the Bee Gees in 1979 really gave me my break at ABC. I had gotten my degree, and I went looking for a job. I couldn't find a job. No one at the time wanted to hire some kid who used to be a basketball player at NBC, ABC, or CBS. You know, I mean, everybody went out to the boondocks to try to make it to New York, and I wanted to start in New York. You know, and eventually, after getting my degree, I went to work for the Port Authority. I went to work for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and I worked at the Port Authority bus terminal down on 41st Street and 8th Avenue, which, if you remember, back in the 70s, was a hellhole. And I'm being nice, okay? But they were building the new bus terminal, and they wanted somebody to come in and hire, you know, people to come sing and do magic acts and anything to distract the bus riders from what was going on at the bus terminal. And that was my job. I was the manager of something like hallucinations, because
I feel like you were the director of the circus or something.
Yes. Go out and just do it. Find somebody. But at the time, there was a Fordham alum at ABC Radio who I kept in contact with. And the one thing about getting a degree from Fordham University is they have 50,000 alumni strong in New York that you can call on. They say call. So I did. I called on him. And it took a year after graduating. But in 1980, late 79, I think. Yeah, late 79, I got a call from him and said, you know, you don't have to work at the Port Authority anymore. I have a job for you here. So he traded me. He traded a secretary at the time, $17,000 a year, for the manager of special projects, and that was me. And I was there. I was relieved to not have to go down to 41st and 8th anymore. And I got to go to where was ABC at 54th and 6th Avenue, which was a glamour spot compared to 41st and 8th. Let me just say that. And I loved it. I really enjoyed my time, my first few months there. And my first few months, my third month at ABC, all the programming people were in a meeting, and I was the manager of special projects, which meant they didn't know what to do with me. They had been trying to do this radio show where they interviewed all the top stars of the 70s, and they played their music and put the interview with the music that they played. And anyway, the Bee Gees were in town, and they didn't have anybody to go interview them because they were in this meeting. And they said, "Oh, send a new guy." So I went out, had an engineer with all of his equipment, recording equipment. We got into the, they were staying at the, I think they were staying at the Statler Hilton or some ritzy place in this big suite. I walk in there and there are the Gibb brothers all sitting around this fireplace. And I walk in and I said, I don't know what the hell to ask them. So I go to, I pull the engineer aside and I said, well, what do I ask him? Anyway, he didn't know. So I asked Barry Gibb, I go, what are the questions that people always ask you? And he gave me these, he gave me five or
that
six.
That was
questions.
Smart. That was ingenious.
And he laughed. He laughed and well, he didn't laugh. He smiled. And that smile I'll never forget because it really eased, made me feel easy. And it the question sounded like I really knew what I was talking about in the interview. So, and that got back to the brass at ABC after I finished and the engineer said, this guy's good. Anyway, that was the start of this guy was good.
I love that story so much because when in doubt, be curious, right? Like if you don't have the answer,
ask
be
questions.
Curious.
Yeah, ask questions. And, you know, because the worst that could happen was I asked dumb questions and that wouldn't have been good. So, you know, anyway, so that was good. And I think also my early, within 6 months there, Howard Cosell was also on my floor. And he was an icon back then with Monday Night Football and Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, and he was just, he was big. He was also known for being very surly. And I would sneak past his office in the morning. He was always there early in the morning. He did a radio show at 5:30 in the morning. I would always sneak past his, you know, tiptoe past his office. And after about, I don't know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, of tiptoeing past his office. One day I was going past his office and he was whistling the Fordham fight song. And I stopped. I said, Mr. Cosell, how do you know the Fordham fight song? And he's smoking a cigar at 7:30 in the morning. And he goes, come on in here. So I went in, I sat down, we talked about sports and what was happening. And, you know, and we did that for the next, you know, a couple of times a week for, gosh, the next few years. And I was so fortunate to have him be in my corner. He would do things for me that he wouldn't do for anybody because he was surly, right? But for some reason, he took a liking to me. And again, the programming people thought, well, you know, Howard likes this guy, you know, the guy must have something. And I, you know, slowly got more, projects to do. And after a couple of years, I think they trusted me to do some things that, they wouldn't have ordinarily trusted someone who'd only been in the business for, a couple of years. So, and, you know, I work for the ABC Radio Network, which is a national network, news, sports, and special programming. And one of the things that they did was provide programming to news talk stations, country stations, rock stations, and top 40 stations. And I said to the programming person at one point, the VP of programming, I said, well, you know, we have a lot of programming for a lot of white listeners, but you're missing about 25% of the population, which at the time it was 25%. And that's the combined audience of Black and Latino and Hispanic at the time. So slowly but surely, we started thinking about doing programming for that segment of the population. And I went to the biggest radio station in the country at the time, WBLS, and forged a relationship with them. And my good friend, Charles Warfield, who's a good friend today, was running WBLS at the time. Inner City Broadcasting was the owner. And it's significant because Percy Sutton, who was the first Black borough president in New York, I'm pretty sure I'm right about that, was the owner of Inner City Broadcasting. I don't know how he got the license for it, but he got it. And Charles and I formed a relationship, and ABC and WBLS formed a relationship, and WBLS benefited greatly from the relationship with ABC, and so did ABC Radio, and it was the start of us producing programming for the Black audience that had never been done before, and advertisers took notice that, well, you know, there was a lot. There, you know, there's a lot of discrimination still on Madison Avenue, you know, because there was a thing that, you know, some advertisers would not advertise on Black radio stations because Black people didn't buy certain things, I guess. But whatever it was, there was a no Black dictate. But ABC's relationship with BLS, unfortunately, and there's another story behind this, gave them some sort of calling card that they could then use and get higher rates. And we used and got higher rates too. I mean, it was a symbiotic relationship that developed. And so that was the jumping off point, really, of my career at ABC, was my relationship with Inner City Broadcasting and WBLS. And my great aunt, my Aunt Willie, I used to stay up at her house in Goshen, and Percy Sutton, who owned the station, the group, also had a house up in Goshen. I ran into him one day, and my Aunt Willie was from Harlem. Percy was the Manhattan borough president, also from Harlem. I ran into him at a supermarket one day, and he had a bunch of flowers. And I said, "Percy, how you doing? What are you doing up here?" He goes, "I have a house, Mr. Brown." He always called me Mr. Brown. But I'm just getting some things, and I'm heading back home. And I said, "Well, my Aunt Willie lives over here, and that's how I'm visiting her." And he looked at me quizzically, and I said, "I'd love for you to say hello to her." He goes, "Sure." So I bring him over to my Aunt Willie's house, and she opens the door. Percy takes the flowers that he had bought for his wife and says, "Ma'am, I brought these for you." And my Aunt Willie says, "Percy Sutton, get your butt in here." I had no idea that they knew each other from Harlem back in the day.
Oh, and I just,
it was the most
that?
Unbelievable.
I love that.
Yeah, it was great. And Percy, with the smoothest move I've ever seen in my life, when he took those flowers and gave them to my Aunt Willie, it was like. So,
and he pretended he didn't know her until that moment. That's hilarious. That's fantastic.
Man. Oh, yeah, it was great. It was great. So, you know, I went back to ABC, and there was a Black radio network also, the Sheridan Radio Network, headed up by a guy by name of Skip Finley. He wanted me to come work for him because he knew I had gotten a sound foundation at ABC. And he was offering me more money, a better position. And I said, "I like what I'm doing right now." And he sent me a letter. And he said, he basically said, "I appreciate you entertaining my offer. And I also understand why you want to stay with ABC. But understand, you have a great responsibility there." And I didn't understand, I didn't really get what he was saying at first. But as time rolled on, I knew that there weren't many Black executives at ABC at the time. I don't know how many Black vice presidents there were. I wasn't a vice president, by the way. I was still manager of special projects. for a while.
That title could last a long time.
Yeah. Actually lasted a year. Then I got moved up to director and whatnot. I got promoted.
Good.
Yeah. But it I was in a spotlight that it was don't fail. Right.
So what was that pressure like?
You know, you asked before, what did basketball, what could I take from it? I took all of the skills that I learned in hoops into my professional life. And hey man, I played in Madison Square Garden where the lights are brightest right there, and did well. So that spotlight that Skip told me that I was going to be under, I wasn't afraid of it, but I did feel a lot of pressure. I did. And so much so that I needed to take some of that pressure off. And, you know, the 3-hour lunches were famous at ABC, and I loved them. Drinking at lunch, oh man, it's great. I could, you know, pound down four or five beers and go back to work. It's great.
It was very socially acceptable at the time in a lot of businesses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And fortunately, Howard and I got along very well, and he often didn't have anybody to go out to lunch with, so he'd say, come on. So I'd go out with him, and there were times when we would not make it back. And it was okay because I was with Howard Cosell. But it wasn't good for my health. This is years, a few years down the road. And my ascension at ABC had kind of leveled off. You know, because I was partying too much, too many 3-hour lunches, too much, too much hanging out, you know, thinking that I was famous. And I slowly got to hire people in those early days. And I actually was able to hire some really, really good people. Who, you know, those, you know, I had to earn my own keep the first few years to prove that I could hire people. But after that, and hiring the people and going out and doing the things that we did, I think that what happened was I started thinking like I didn't need to work that hard anymore. Right, because I had good people supporting me. And maybe it wasn't so much that. Maybe it was that I just started getting caught up in the high life. And the entertaining, I'll do the entertaining and do a little bit of the work instead of doing the work, continuing to do the work, and continuing to being innovative. And having the fantastic people who I had working for me support me in ways that were great. And I you know, so the last few years of my, you know, I was there for 9 years before I had to go into treatment. And I would say the last 3 years of I was an absent boss for half the day. I would go out to lunch and sometimes not come back. I would go out to lunch and there was anything but innovation after 3 o'clock when I got back. Right, I couldn't wait to leave again. Leave work at 5:30. Which was acceptable because I could go back to where I was at lunch. And I knew that the I depended on the people who worked for me to continue driving that department. And, there were people who supported me during those times when we were doing really, really innovative things and big things and Rolling Stones tour and Live Aid and providing programming to coming up with the ideas to provide laugh tracks to radio stations that they didn't have to do themselves. Coming up with things like that, the Susan O'Connells of the world and Gloria Briggs of the world and Nancy Abramsons of the world. Those women, in the end, they saved my ass. I don't know if I could say that, but in the end, they saved my ass. And that because they were good. And I think Nancy and Susan, I think Susan just retired last year. And Nancy Abramson is like senior vice president of some programming outfit. And I loved the fact that they went on and became VPs of this. And they continued to do great things. But more importantly, they set the foundation for me to continue to come back from treatment. And even those first year, I was still a little shaky because I almost got fired, right? And they were the ones who really supported me and held up the department in a way that people still wanted to come work there. And so I really want to pay tribute to the Nancys and the Ron Rivlins and the Gloria Briggs and the Karen Freemans of the world, because they were fantastic when I was in treatment.
Well, I'm sort of hearing something in your story that you can tell me if it's true or not. Even when you were not at your best, you held a vision for what you wanted to do at ABC that was deep and clear and interesting. So even though you started with that idea, you attracted some really great talent, and they were able to hold that idea and vision, even if you were kind of half in, half out. And that vision and that purpose kind of held things together. They held things together for sure. And then you could re-enter and do your part. But I'm hearing a story about, a deep purpose and mission can often trump a leader.
Well, maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's part of the culture that was being built, because they certainly made it a fun place to be, and they certainly, and I knew it was important for everyone to be able to feel like they were running their own little section, right? And they were free to innovate, right? So, I'll go with that. But
well,
they kept it going.
They kept it going, but I think it's not just your story, but I think it's a common story of an absentee boss. And sometimes a lot of things get done when the boss leaves. if there's a strong team and a strong foundation, right? So you can see that in sports, like coaches get changed out and teams remain intact. And anyway, I think it's beautiful to give them credit. And I would also say that even if you were out taking care of your disease, you were there in spirit in some ways.
Well, they sure were such a strong part of that the culture that was being developed at ABC Radio Network back in that day. Strong part. A lot of money, making a lot of money, living the high life in New York City, and having a modicum of what I thought was power, because I was hanging out with powerful people, was not really good for me. It really wasn't. I drank to excess, and that in itself is the answer to your is an answer to your question. Yes, I had learned how to handle pressure, but I also found another escape. And it really almost took me out. Plain and simple.
Yeah. We need a variety of stress relieving tools. If we only have one tool and it's alcohol, it's not so great.
So, I was seduced by the power of New York City, and also seduced by the power of working in the entertainment industry, and then there was a seduction and them giving me a little bit more responsibility every year, and then I was a low-level vice president at the at an early age before I was 30, and that didn't happen. I'd go out to the executive meetings out in Palm Springs, and I'd look around, and there may be two other people of color, no women, but two other men who may have been at that level. So, yeah. And again, there was, I just felt the pressure. That Skip
Yeah.
Finley letter was like glaring.
So your
I didn't.
story earlier was really about, in my mind, transforming the radio industry, the broadcasting industry around race. Would you
Well,
agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that in this way. Race is it's a social construct. It's not even a real thing. Right. But it sure was a thing on Madison Avenue. And the fact of the matter is, Black radio stations and white radio stations, they would overpay to reach the white listener, and somebody had to pay for that overpaying. Somebody had to pay for that overpaying, and that was the Black radio stations. So even though they would be higher ranked, they would get less money. And even though the white radio station would be the third ranked station, they would get first rank money. And there's only so much money to go around, so somebody had to get job, and it was always the Black and the Hispanic stations. So, how do you prove the value of a listener of color, right? So that's what I set out. I was, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a part of that. I was not the only person doing it, but I wanted to be a part of it, and that's what I felt I was doing at ABC. That's why I was there. Right. It was clear to me that I wasn't supposed to be anyplace else. I wasn't supposed to go to television. I had offers to go to TV. I was supposed to do exactly what I was doing. And I'm so glad I did. It was it proved to be fruitful for me. And very, very fruitful for ABC, because believe me, they wouldn't have done it unless there was money in it for them,
There
right?
was a it was an ethical problem to be solved through a business case.
That's right. If I had to make the business case, and once I showed them where the green was, There was no black or white.
That's a good line, Daryl. So let's fast forward to today.
Yeah.
Is there equity now? Is there still inequities around?
I will say that the problem with our country, and it's a deep-seated one, and it goes back 400 years to the emancipation of slaves. White people did not want slaves, the emancipated slave, to have equal land. Well, let's just say they have equal value, because there isn't enough for everybody. There is a scarcity mentality that pervaded America back then, and it's still pervasive today. There isn't enough housing, there isn't enough money. It's just a mentality that there isn't enough. And so, in answer to your question, I think anything, I think it still goes on. I don't know.
And in this, I agree with that. And we can see that in, racial wealth gaps in all sorts of ways, right? But in the area of broadcasting, what progress have we made? Have you made?
Okay. I will say, well, let me explain it to you this way. The only way that equity was ever, well, when I was working in radio, the only way that equity was made was when you could attach your audience to a black audience to a white audience and sell at that rate, but sell it as a whole. And isn't it ironic that that's really what we are, right? As a society, we are a whole. But sell it all for a dollar, as opposed to the white radio station getting $1.25 and the black radio station getting 65 cents. Yeah. Sell it all as a dollar, and yeah, everybody wins. So that happened maybe a little bit for a while. And then the radio industry tanked. In 2008, right, when everything went to hell, the radio, the pie was only so much, and the first thing to go was, well, do we really need to be on those black stations and the Hispanic stations? Do we really need it? We had it like this before, and it was working, so let's go back to that.
So going back is like a theme.
Let's make America great again. Okay. So, I don't hate to be explicit about it. I will be explicit about it.
Yeah.
But going back to the 50s was exactly when you had, Aunt Jemima on the face of pancakes and on syrup bottles, and you had, you had butlers on trains who were all black, and you had waiters at hotels and all that. They were all black. Those were the only jobs that were handed out, right? So, anyway, that make
a there's still a lot of work to be done.
There's still a lot of work to be done, and we had our George Floyd moment in 2020. And a lot of corporations said, oh, I'm going to invest in this, and I'm going to put money in diversity. And here we are 4 years later. And we have states, I live in Texas, and we have a governor who has said that if any university spends money on diversity, equity, inclusion, you will be fired, and that funding will be, you will be defunded. So now you're being chastised for trying to show that we're all the same. We're all living together. We're all have equal value, right? And here's how it happened. Here's how the, you know, let's take away these books. I could go on. I don't, this is not what it's
well, called. I'm actually, my next article for Forbes, the working title is DEIB is not political, it's essential. So I will be coming back and interviewing you for that.
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a really good, important thing that has been weaponized, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, you know, Laurel, it's a great question, but that theme of, you know, going back to my high school days and, you know, having to prove that I was better than, and feeling so uncomfortable about being othered back in my grade school and high school, and then in college, even when the Boston Celtics were thinking about drafting me, what I heard was, oh, they heard you have an Italian girlfriend. Does it ever stop? Right? So,
yeah, so it's two steps forward, three steps back some days.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. And
yeah.
You know, now I get to see, and I'm still pushing it, right? I'm still pushing it. What is the value of the African-American consumer? Isn't it of equal value of the white consumer? But unless I show, you know, unless I could prove, and I say I, it wasn't just me.
Yeah. But you were one of the pioneers in the movement and in broadcasting.
Yeah, definitely at ABC. There were others. Definitely were others, but definitely at ABC. Getting a white institution like Disney to invest in that, and then the big investment was the Tom Joyner Morning Show, to get them to put millions into, a couple of million dollars into paying this guy, you know, to do a national radio show. It was in keeping with where I always felt the money was. But getting a group of people together at ABC to actually make that happen, and getting ABC and Disney to invest in it, was monumental. But what was even better was the 65% margins that investment returned.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back. It's not black. It's not white. It's all about the green. Right.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, leaving that charge. Yeah. It was monumental to my career. I was sober, by the way, by this time. I put the drink down. And my career took off. Fancy that.
Having a clear head is good for being a better leader, right?
Yeah. And you know, Laurel, the leader part of it, it wasn't just about me. I was able to provide opportunity for other Black vice presidents inside of a company that didn't have enough of them, that there was no way to get there. So to be able to do that and to develop a unit of, you know, I don't know, 150 people or so, that were, those, there were jobs. No, those jobs didn't exist before. That was my contribution. You know, I will be forever grateful for them for giving me, opening up that door, right? For not just, you know, not just me, but for all the people who came, all the people who came after me and carried that torch. And Tom Joyner was the guy, though. I did it behind the scenes, but he did it on camera, and he did it on the radio, on air, and proved that that his show, the black audience, was worth paying top dollar for, right? It was fantastic. It was like a new day. So I you know, from a career standpoint, I spent 30 years, almost 30 years at ABC. You know, that I got to develop morning shows for the black audience and for the Latinx audience. I got to develop, I got to work with a guy who owned Spanish radio stations in LA, Miami, New York, Puerto Rico, and he went to Fordham University. Raul Alarcón was a class of 86, a few years after me, but you know, Fordham moves at everywhere.
I love that thread. I really love the connection between you and Howard Cosell and the Fordham fight song. Did you ever find out how he knew it? He just knows a lot about sports.
Well, first of all, he was a basketball player. He went to NYU. And one of the games that Howard reported on was when Fordham played Notre Dame in the Garden. And Notre Dame, I was a senior in high school being recruited by Fordham. Howard covered that game, and he covered it from the standpoint of Notre Dame's going to kill Fordham. I don't know why I'm here. Anyway, I'm sitting up in the stands watching little Fordham beat the number five team in the country, the fifth ranked team in the country. And Madison Square Garden was exploding. New York City, that team that year went 26-3. And that's when I decided that I would go to Fordham, by the way. I was being recruited by Michigan, Princeton, Stanford, University of Virginia, all these schools. But that game and how the Madison Square Garden felt that night was why I went. Anyway, so Howard's there. So I think that he knew my career at Fordham, he knew that it was this little school that did some big things. And that's
and then
how I
you became his drinking buddy at lunch.
That's right.
I love all the connections.
Yeah. Howard and I, we did a lot together all the way through to the end. And Fordham, and you know, and then, you know, Fordham has a lot of their School of Communications, and Syracuse, the Newhouse School up at Syracuse. They put out a lot of people who were at ESPN and at ABC and CBS. We're all over the place there. So those connections are always great. Raul, and that was a major deal. So I had it on the black radio side and on the Latin radio side. And between the two of them, I was able to hire people from both cultures who were familiar with the music and familiar with how things should be. And they got in elevated positions because of that. And, you know, we did ESPN in Espanol, right? You know, I didn't do that, but that would have never happened unless we had those relationships. So, yeah, I loved the part that I played, as small or long, who's to tell? I don't know. I don't really care. You know, I just know that it was a good feeling, and talk about passion, about doing something. I love going to work every day, until that advertising pie started getting so small, they started squeezing back to how America was in the 50s, and the money started drying up, and you know, I was being asked by a new company that bought ABC Radio, you know, to make some drastic cuts in my unit, and it was just a matter of time before they would have. I was making too much money and doing too well for them, and it was a matter of time before they got me too. But they wanted me to fire some people first, and you know, I knew it was time to go. And my boys were 4 and 6 at the time, and I said I had my, you know, years. What a career! I was so, you know, I was delighted with what I was able to do, and now I had these two guys that I could go. I was the vice president of the PTA, and I was known around my kids' elementary school as Andrew and Daryl's dad. You know, there was no 3-hour lunches, no Madison Square Garden.
Will, in our next episode, we'll talk a lot about that because you've done a lot since ABC Radio and Disney. And so in our next chapter, we will talk all about that.
Sounds
the
good.
most important job you could ever have and least appreciated is being a great parent. So I'm excited to hear about that. Anything else you want to say about your broadcasting career?
I really want to tip my hat to the people who came before me, you know, the Skip Finleys, the Charles Warfields, the guys who worked, the Barry Mayos of the world, of that world, who really paved the way and did things that, you know, that weren't done before. We all took advantage of the opportunities that were laid out for us, and it was really it was my honor to be able to work with them. But there were people who were in Black radio way before me, way before Charles and Skip, that really paved the way. They were the ones who had their nose to the grindstone, who took 65 cents when right, and still made a living, right, out of it. They were the ones who I'll never forget. I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I saw Willie. What was his last name? He was a tackle for the Packers who actually owned an AM radio station. I went to meet with him, and he was carrying a refrigerator into the radio station on his back. Right. That to me is what Black radio was back then. I'll end on that one.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your life and your story with us. It was so wonderful to hear.
Sure.
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.